Hello, and welcome to the Blockchain.com podcast. My name is Nicholas Carey, co-founder and vice chairman of Blockchain.com. Our latest segment of the Blockchain.com podcast, Trading 101, dives into the dynamic world of cryptocurrency trading. From how-to education walkthroughs to current trends and analysis, we'll share practical tips and expert interviews. In today's episode, we're unpacking crypto regulation. We explore the role regulation plays in enhancing crypto's legitimacy, trust and adoption, and examine how frameworks address consumer protection, market transparency, and innovation. With the much anticipated Markets and Crypto Assets Regulation, MiCA, set to take a substantial impact in the EU market, today we're joined by Josh Peschko, Global Head of Compliance at Talos. So we're super excited to have you, Josh. Thank you so much for joining us. We have a little tradition around here. We always like to ask, how did you earn your first buck, your first dollar? And let us know how you kind of became aware of money's role in society.
Yeah. Hi, Nick. And thanks for having me. Very excited to chat for a little bit about this stuff. So my first dollar that I can remember earning was probably before you can, you know, really work officially. I was paid $20 to dance with my cousin when I was 7 years old at my aunt's wedding. $20 for a 7 year old is, you know, an unlimited amount of money. My whole intention was to spend all of it at the arcade that was in the hotel, which I did. I went directly to the Double Dragon arcade machine and I spent all $20. And there is nothing more exciting when you are 7 years old than having $20 in an arcade. So I will never forget that moment where I was paid to dance with my cousin. You know, for more official jobs, you know, I you do the normal things as you're a teenager, and I was a valet driver, which I learned the importance of not overestimating or over describing how good you are at driving a stick shift, which at the time I was not. So I learned that lesson the hard way. And then as I you know, went to college and started working officially, and really started kind of honing my focus into finance. I was really, really fascinated about the concept of risk. And I wanted to work at a risk consultant was my plan. I ended up landing at JP Morgan in the risk department and was really fascinated around how do you build controls and make things more efficient, you know, to help people that are really, you know, the PhDs of the world and the quants of the world excel in what they can do, but still do it in a very compliant way. And that's kind of what led me to Talos.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think so much of, you know, our careers in life really is just about, you know, basically learning, scaffolding, and ultimately learning how to apply risk in all our decisions, whether it's getting out of our comfort zone, training a little bit harder, and then ultimately making investments with our time and maybe more importantly with our precious resources and money. And so I'm super excited to dive into these topics with you, and especially on the regulatory side, with your background in risk at JPM, to talk a little bit more about how that's matured in the crypto space. But before we get there, can you kind of provide maybe a brief overview of Talos, the company you work for, and your role there?
Yep, absolutely. So Talos provides institutional grade infrastructure that really supports the full life cycle of digital asset trading. So right now, Nick, if you and I want to buy Bitcoin, you know, we open up our phone and we, you know, hit buy. And maybe if we're some sort of pro customer, there's some sort of limited, you know, limit orders you can put in place. But we're, for the most part, we're living in the ecosystem and trading with one counterparty. That's not the way that institutions trade. So think hedge fund, asset manager, somebody that's trading in a much more larger dollar value. They're going to have multiple counterparties, so not just Coinbase, but Kraken and Binance. And wherever the liquidity is, they're going to want to source to make sure that they're getting the best price. They're also going to want to trade a little bit differently. So, you know, market orders aren't going to be as frequent, which is when you trade whatever the price is, that's the price you're getting. They might be want to be more passive. They want to make sure their orders aren't hitting the market with too much speed. So then the price drops or price goes up too quickly. So there's institutional traders are a much different environment, and they require a different set of skills. And that's really what Talos provides. So, you know, anything from price discovery to execution through to settlement, we really, you know, kind of empower them to trade anywhere safely, securely, optimally, and at scale.
Cool. Cool. Thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, it's funny. It's important for our retail customers as well as our institutional customers to hear about these things, because a lot of the strategies that are used by institutions in a much simpler and simplified way can be adopted by regular users, whether it's dollar cost averaging, being thoughtful about, you know, sort of a portfolio approach to how they think about their investments, and more. Now, obviously, institutions apply much more sophistication and institutional grade resources against those strategies and their perspectives on the market. But ultimately, it's important to hear about these things. So let's talk a little bit about regulation in the crypto space. Crypto is sort of now a decade old asset class. In many ways, the regulatory frameworks have caught up in a lot of ways to mature the market per se. And so talk to us a little bit about how important regulation is in the crypto space, especially in the context of institutional adoption, which has in a lot of ways lagged in this asset class in comparison to how so many consumers have had access to crypto really over the course of the previous decade.
Yeah, for sure. Regulation is huge for any sort of market to evolve. All right. I think sometimes regulation can be viewed negatively and viewed as something that's going to stifle progress. And I think even when I came into crypto, I'd spent almost 20 years in traditional finance, both at JP Morgan and then at AQR Asset Management. And regulation isn't always clear anyway. So I think the term regulatory clarity, we need regulatory clarity for the institutions to join, that is definitely true. But that doesn't mean we're always going to have clarity. You do need something. And right now, what we have, at least in the U.S., is kind of ill-fitting kind of gray rules with a more aggressive regulator on top of it. That very much stifles innovation, and that is very hard to live with. You know, the only people that win in those scenarios are the law firms that you're calling constantly to figure out, what's the best way to do things compliantly. And I think by and large, the companies that I've met and people that I've spoken to really are trying to do the right thing. So rules are in progress. Hopefully they move a little bit faster. And we're seeing that, in Europe. Again, I think the type of rule and regulation is really important, right? So there's a concept of a rules-based approach to regulation. And these are going to be really prescriptive and, very quantitative, very lines, hard in the sand. You can do this, you can't do this. You can do this, but only do so much of it. Think about like kind of tax rules, right? The IRS rules are going to be very prescriptive and there's a place for those. But does that, is the IRS known for innovation? Not so much. And it really does kind of hamper, the progress things can make, because especially in crypto or really in finance in general, things change so quickly and bodies of law, certainly do not. So, rules-based approach, I think, for crypto probably would not encourage a lot of innovation, unfortunately. And I don't think anybody's talking about it that way, but it is something to keep in mind, because I think there is a default sometimes, by some regulators to do that. If they're scared of something, okay, you want rules, here's a rule, right? And throwing something in there that really doesn't encourage innovation. With that said, having something that's clear could be helpful. And never doubt the creativity of finance to figure out ways to do things in compliance with certain prescriptive rules. But again, is that really the point? Is the point to figure out, how to get around these rules, or is it to build a body that can encourage to, growth in a safe way? And that's really what a principles-based set of rules is, right? So a principles-based set of rules are really kind of, think about it as kind of more high statements, qualitative statements that encourage or that require good behavior, but yeah. They don't really tell you exactly how to do that. Now, these laws are still long, and MiCA is a really good example of this that's coming out, and we could talk a little bit more about that. We're talking almost close to 1,000 pages have been written so far about MiCA, but I would largely consider it a principles-based rule set, which can help companies comply if they're being thoughtful and doing the right thing, without really telling them exactly what they need to do.
Yep. And I think it's important, like you mentioned, regulation basically helps provide, a bit of confidence in a market. You want to make sure your car isn't going to blow up. You want to know that, it's going to have a seatbelt and a certain type of operating system so that it can drive down the road in a safe and compliant way. And I think American entrepreneurs certainly want to be compliant, but they also, you know, American entrepreneurship is really based on that principles approach, which is almost sort of like having a Hippocratic oath for business, which is primarily start from a do no harm principle and then go out and build things that people find useful and appreciate the market principles with that. Now, what's interesting is that in a lot of ways, Europe has kind of moved more quickly in the regulatory environment, specifically related to crypto. And let's talk a little bit about that. So you talked about the markets and crypto assets regulation, or MiCA, which is its acronym in Europe as it's known. Talk to us a little bit about how that body of regulation has sort of come to fruition, maybe a little bit about the process that it takes. And then, you know, I think like a lot of regulation, there are going to be people that are critical of it. There are people that are, you know, happy to see it come. Some clarity is better than none, will be argued by many. So, you know, what are we going to have to inherit as an industry? And, you know, what sort of opportunities does this, you know, potentially sort of give Europe heading into 2024, 25 that maybe differentiates it from other markets in the world?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. And to be fair, you know, MiCA is super encouraging. And, I've yet to find somebody who's been hypercritical of it, which I don't know if I've ever encountered that with a rule. But, you know, it is not done yet. So the process is always long for any rule, even if you're moving quickly. And I think it was first proposed in 2020. And then it was approved in June of 2023 to actually start moving along and start releasing these consultation papers, they call them, which are kind of large pieces of you know, discussion almost about certain requirements that they're thinking about putting in place. And then there's a kind of a back and forth with industry. So they've released two of those consultations. There's a third coming up. We're expected the first quarter here in 2024. And then the rule is supposed to go final right now, you know, in December of this year, 2024, with I think about a 2-year compliance period. So we still have pretty long way to go. There's still a lot of unknowns. But I think the most encouraging thing that you see in there is, again, how deep it goes and how knowledgeable they are when they're writing this. And the detail they go around a registration regime for any sort of new body of law. Registering companies that are doing that activity is step one. That is the 101 of any sort of body of law. And right now we don't have that in crypto. That's one of the biggest frustrations I've had since I've been working in crypto is really finding out who people are, right? Yes, every company is required to do KYC checks. And if you're working in an institutional environment, you do KYB checks where you kind of know your business. And those are super important. And you know, I think crypto has a lot of work to do. And there's a lot of talk around, you know, those sorts of checks. But in general, right, just registering companies so when something goes wrong, you know who to call is not really there on a global scale. So, you know, the registration regime around whether you're an issuer, so you have a project that you want to launch, or if you're a CASP, right, so you're an exchange or you're somebody trading crypto, and you have to go to this regulator and fill out this form and very basic things around who owns this company. What's their address of this company? What's the phone number of this company? Now, these things have to happen just for any business to start, but we don't have that centralized look of source of information right now for crypto. And I think that is really one of the key parts of this. And one of the parts I'm most excited for about is a more kind of global licensing, even though it's EU-based, it's going to be a licensing program for people to kind of follow through. And then again, although this is a disclosure and kind of principles-based approach, there are certain things like capital requirements, you know, that require that you have to do. You need to have like business recovery plans, right? So you have to have things that you would expect these companies to do. But you know, in crypto, things happen fast, right? Where a company starts up, maybe they started up in a place where there wasn't a lot of clarity around regulation, so they got a business license, and then you know, a year later, you know, their business has quadrupled and they have, you know, 1,000 employees. And all of a sudden they haven't spent the time kind of building the controls that they have in place. What MiCA does is really give you this known thing that you have to comply with, that you have to fill out. And again, it lets the regulators kind of know who you are. So if something does go wrong, you know exactly who to call. You know, the analogy I like to use is kind of, you know, if you're a parent or if you've ever had to watch kids, you know, the pool is always not the safest place to have your kids play, But if you have three kids and they're all in the pool, you can look at the pool. So you need all the kids in the pool, right? And then you can see, all right, who can swim? Who needs help swimming? Who needs to put the floaty on? You know, you have more control over what's happening in the pool if you have everybody in the pool. And right now, that is not the case.
Yeah, and I think that your point you made about the sort of approach that the European Commission took, consultative, basically, you know, asking advice from the industry, and then, you know, sort of approving this through their process, and then allowing for a multi-year implementation period, gives people a significant amount of time to basically understand what's coming down the pipeline in terms of what they're going to have to comply with, and then preparing for those things. And so, you know, Europe is definitely leading the way in terms of building a single market access for crypto, that at least everyone understands what, you know, the rules of the pool will be. Yeah. How does that compare, you know, to the UK, for example? You know, famously, the UK has been, you know, sort of removing itself from Europe via the Brexit process. And what maybe are the differences or opportunities that could differentiate the UK's approach to crypto in general?
Yeah, so UK is doing a lot of work as well. I would say that the biggest difference I've seen in the UK is they're very disclosure focused. So they recently had an advertisement rule that came out around crypto. But again, it's about making sure that you're highlighting the risks of what you're doing. And that is really kind of, I would say, the biggest linchpin or the biggest focus that they have really is around disclosure and making sure that you are very, very clear and very, very apparent about the risks, again, and the dangers or the you know, that you know what you're doing before you enter into any sort of agreement. You know, certainly Mika has a lot of that as well, and there's an expectation, but I think there's and this has always been kind of the case for the UK regulators, there is much more of a retail-based advertisement focused. That's how they kind of control a lot of it.
Yeah, and the way that gets practically implemented in the UK is they have these things called financial promotions. Basically, as a retail user, before you can actually sign up and use a product, you have to describe who you are, what your intentions are, what your potential net worth is, how frequently you might want to use these things. You have to declare your sort of a self-assessment about your financial literacy. And then they can implement further sort of, you know, obligations on the service providers, including cooling off periods and other things. And so whether you're investing as an angel investor or a retail investor in crypto or doing more sophisticated things, these are the types of approaches that the UK has in their jurisdiction. So, all right. Well, it's obviously been an exciting start to 2024 with the long awaited and now approved ETFs out of the SEC. It's been a 10-year sort of process for those to finally get approved. What do you make of that? And, you know, what do you sort of take, what are the takeaways, you know, now that those barriers have been removed and some of the largest financial houses on Wall Street are basically, you know, offering ETFs to their clients?
Yeah, what a start, huh? I mean, compared to last year, starting the year with some good news, certainly is just a nice breath of fresh air. I think the market's been a little bit disappointed, obviously, with the reaction of the price. I think one thing to keep in mind is now that we're kind of using, you know, frameworks and wrappers that are in traditional finance, like an ETF, things just don't move as quick. So the approval is humongous, and it is a sign of legitimacy. The fact that you have such big players now that are talking about crypto and marketing, you know, their products around crypto, spending time in DC talking about crypto, you know, there is a lot of effort spent by some of those larger players, you know, that have very, very strong relationships in DC. And, you know, and I think Bitcoin, like a lot of other people that have gotten into crypto, is usually the first step. So, you know, I think there was concern that, you know, maybe it's just Bitcoin. Like maybe a lot of these players don't care about other products. And you know, I think we are going to see some sort of continued adoption and education as they sort of ramp up their engines, understanding more about the ecosystem. So I'm really encouraged about just the amount of attention that, again, these very large players are going to be giving crypto in general. And I think that'll move things along. It just moves things along a bit slower, I think, than crypto is used to, right? So I think crypto, you know, I think we are very, we're very excited and we're very optimistic. And, but you know, we can't always control, some of the movements, especially, you know, in DC or movements around some sort of traditional asset firms and when they start adopting this stuff. So this makes it so much easier for, large institutions to trade a product like a Bitcoin, like an ETF, but that does not happen overnight. And I think there's, you know, rightfully so, this is not something people spend a lot of time on, but you know, the movements of, like a mutual fund board or, an investment committee and a large asset manager is just very, very slow. Right. So, you know, working at a large asset manager for as long as I did, when you introduce a new asset class, there's a lot of work that needs to be done just initially, proving that you should be adding this asset class to some sort of like multi-strategy, right? So you need to prove that, you know, this additional exposure is going to be diversifying, right? That your Sharpe ratio, that's going to increase. Like, otherwise, you know, why would we add this piece, this new thing that we didn't have before? And you do that, whether it be, you know, some sort of commodity that you've never traded before or some sort of currency you've never traded before. It's the same sort of process where you need to prove that this is going to be additive to your portfolio that you're managing. And you're managing that for other people, right? Next step is really going to be to disclose that. So now you've added new risk. And I think this is something important that was kind of hidden or not talked about in this sort of context around how the BTF or the ETF approval happened. So Gensler had a bunch of tweets before the approval came out, kind of about, you know, the way I took it was messaging to these larger platforms that have mutual funds, think like a target date fund, right? Saying, yeah. Hey, like this is going to come out, but it's on you to make sure that people know that they have exposure to it and that it's risky. And you saw this in his, you know, I guess you can't call it a dissent because he approved the application, but you know,
this was pretty good.
Yes. Yeah. She's always great. You know, but he said very similar things where he's just describing kind of this asset class as being volatile, that his hands were tied. And again, I read that from sitting in the seats that I have sat before saying, okay, we have to, if we want to put this into our products, even though we think it's going to be better, we think the performance of these funds will be better long term. We really have to disclose this, and we have to spend money on counsel figuring out how to disclose this. We're going to have to explain to our board why we're including this asset class. So I think he really put some hurdles in place for these companies. Now, again, I think some are going to probably wait and see, you know, wait for other companies to adopt and put those in their funds. But, you know, eventually performance is kind of what wins the day. So I think this whole thing takes a while, right? So board meetings only happen quarterly. Even when you change your prospectus and maybe this isn't considered a material change to your prospectus, there's some sort of lag there where investors have a chance to redeem. So there's just a lot of kind of these long time periods. And when I say long, I'm not saying years and years, but I don't think we'll see any sort of meaningful additions to, again, say like a target date fund, you know, for at least another, you know, half of a year, 6 months. You know, there's just target date funds alone, I don't know, there's $2 trillion, something like that. And I think the people are making the case now, and you'll see this more and more, that a little bit of crypto exposure, a little bit of Bitcoin exposure is very diversifying. Yes, it's volatile, but if you manage that risk correctly, you do end up with a broader diversified portfolio. So again, I think the facts will rule the day there, but we just have a lot of kind of entrenched procedures that are in place that are just going to kind of take time before you start seeing some of these, you know, larger inflows.
I think that's a really great perspective to share. There's also a unique dynamic with the GBTC trust that became an ETF, where a lot of people had funds locked up for a long time that are potentially exiting those positions, and also allocating into the other ETFs that have a preferential fee structure. So you're seeing some market shakeout from this ETF launch. I think everyone that's been in this space for a while, while anticipating this and seeing a lot of positivity out of the institutional adoption of crypto, is also saying, hey, this is a longer term, you know, sort of milestone, and it's an important one. But again, this asset class is just at the beginning of really changing the way we think about informatics as an asset class in general. And you hear Larry Fink talking about this, which is a huge endorsement, but also he understands that data is valuable. And in the future, if data can basically wrap the planet in capabilities to exchange you know, precious information over the internet, that's going to be highly valuable. They want to, you know, be participating and offering their clients these things. So you're getting pressure from clients, and then also the market. And finally, the asset class has matured significantly over the, you know, the last decade. And, you know, the SEC was patient through this process. And I think the industry exercised extraordinary patience through this process. But in the end, the outcome is that these things are now available to the vast majority of Americans via the brokerage accounts, which is a huge deal. So I think what you're saying is it took a while to get here. There's going to be, you know, more patience required on behalf of the industry to get maybe additional, you know, sort of exposure to crypto baskets or other crypto asset classes beyond Bitcoin. But the march is on, and we now have sort of a pathway for seeing that come to fruition. Okay, cool. Well, maybe let's get sort of into a future state thinking a little bit here. You know, what do you see as maybe the greatest regulatory, you know, headwinds or tailwinds globally, and sort of give us sort of a, maybe a, you know, your view on 2024 and beyond, you know, as a sort of high level, like what are things people should be thinking about?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think in the US, it's always kind of unknown, and we have an election coming up this year, which tends to slow things down. I spent a lot of time in DC last year, and that's a big part of my job. You know, yes, I spent a lot of time internally, you know, building the right processes and making sure that we're compliant with any sort of regulations. But, you know, externally with the state of regulation, there is a chance to kind of educate regulators and lawmakers. And, you know, one of my big takeaways was a lot of the work is done and it's been done really well. So there's rules that are written that, you know, I feel like, you know, I don't want to say they're pencils down, but I think, you know, there's a feeling, kind of a bipartisan feeling, that they're in a pretty good place. And then you're just kind of stuck, you know, with the state of Congress and trying to get things moved. So, you know, that's a silver lining, I guess, is that it does feel like there's something that's kind of ready to go, or at least, you know, and it has been voted out of certain committees. But you're kind of just, you don't have control really beyond that. So I do think that, you know, we're always going to be in the U.S., you know, a little bit, you know, our hands are kind of tied with the machinations there. But, you know, I think, you know, having Meek and stuff also encourages movement, right? So as we start seeing companies, you know, move to different jurisdictions, or if that as Meek gets closer to a final rule, you know, that can certainly spur some changes as well. I think the biggest thing that I worry about, honestly, is the lack of, you know, the regulation that we've had for so long, you know, another FTX. It was just so disheartening just having something like that happen, really just because of what happened to the progress of some rules. We had some really good rules and a lot of focus on rules in the US, you know, right before that happened. And had it not happened, you know, who knows where we'd be with some of those rules. But man, like, you would go to conferences and every single panel or every single person you would speak to would be, you know, a senator or a congressman. And again, coming from traditional finance, those people never showed up to those. You did not get any congressman going to, you know, a mutual fund conference. Right. So, you know, there was just a lot of attention and energy behind it. And I think that, you know, having something like that happen again would really be, you know, I think take some of the wind out of one of our sails. So hopefully we get regulation in place. I think largely people are doing the right thing. But, you know, without some sort of body of law, you know, there's still going to be some, you know, a bad actor, you know, out there that can kind of skate by. So we really got to focus on them.
Okay. Well, I think I would classify this as, you know, 2024, strong start to the year with, you know, the SEC approving the crypto ETFs, the implementation coming forward with MiCAR and the UK and other jurisdictions, basically all signaling, you know, sort of a pro-technology, pro-digitization of finance strategy. All those things I kind of say are ubiquitous with a longer term adoption of blockchain type technologies, and the role of crypto in those, I think, is becoming increasingly solidified. That being said, you know, there have been setbacks, I think it's important to acknowledge that the justice system, at least in the US, has, you know, also healed some of the damage caused by individual actors, and to differentiate the technology from, you know, individuals that are causing harm is always important. So the good news is we have loads of rules to deal with people that cause fraud. And that's been the same, whether it's been in selling TVs or, you know, bad insurance policies or on, you know, ripening bananas. And so appreciate all those perspectives. And thank you so much for coming in and explaining to us a little bit more about, you know, the global regulatory landscape as it relates to crypto.
Remember to subscribe to our channel and leave us a review if you enjoyed today's episode. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Carey, and on behalf of the entire blockchain.com team, thank you for tuning in. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are for institutional and informational purposes only and should not be considered as financial advice. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and consult with a qualified financial professional before making any investment decisions. Thank you.